Let's talk.
John Brown. Divide and rule. The real lives of rural women, past and present, has been described as a groundbreaking feminist analysis of British monarchy out this year. Saints or sinners, perfect princesses or difficult duchesses, monarchy's saviours or its destroyers. It is a fascinating book by Catherine Mayer. I'm delighted to say that Catherine joins me live on the line now. Catherine, good morning to you. Or good afternoon even, sorry.
Is it?
Yes, I don't know. Yes, it is. It's Wednesday.
everything feels like afternoon at the moment.
Yes, indeed. Just explain a little bit about your background and why you are so eminently qualified to write Divide and Rule.
Well, one thing is that I'm very, very, very old, which is useful for history. I have been covering the royals actually first met the then future King Charles since the 80s, which means that I'm the same age as Princess Diana would have been.
Yes, but I mean the 80s was only 10 years ago, because I'm the same vintage, so therefore, you know, right. Exactly.
there are a lot of people these days who don't remember any of that.
I know.
I had a very strange encounter with Charles when I was working at the kind of publication that does not cover the royals. I started my life in journalism at The Economist, and he invited himself there to ask people of his own age, which disqualified me, how he might best use his position. But I met him, and the sheer peculiarity of a young man, as he then was, thinking he'd go and sit with a bunch of kind of journalists and talk about what he should be doing with his life, was so interesting that I kind of got the bug then. But then I ended up being a foreign correspondent based in London for a German news organization. And so I was covering the royals day in, day out for the most turbulent decade, until it became even more turbulent recently.
Yeah.
So the 90s. So all the way through, all those royal divorces and the Windsor fire and the death of Princess Diana, that was my beat. And I've covered them since then. And in 2015, published a in-depth biography of Charles, who I got considerable access to for that biography, by royal standards, considerable access.
Yeah.
I've continued to be interested and have met many of them, have had a lot of access over the years, but also done a lot of thinking about them and the institution. And I'm also a feminist, so, you know, obviously those things kind of come together in this project.
Because here's the thing. I mean, I hadn't realized that Charles had gone to The Economist, and that sounds like a very early sort of attempt to have a sort of focus group and what should I be doing?
Yeah.
And, you know, which is unheard of if you think about it. But, you know, pre the 90s, isn't it, really?
Well, he was. I mean, one of the reasons I found him more interesting than many members of his family is because he is more interesting than many members of his family, because a lot of royals don't have, and the most obvious example here is Andrew, who I also have spent significant amounts of time with. He has no curiosity about the outside world whatsoever, just sort of takes his position for granted in very, of course, ways that have proved extremely unfortunate. Whereas Charles always had this notion that he needed to be doing something, and doing something by way of public service, but in a role that was both ill-defined and restricted. And so, but, you know, to think that The Economist would offer you that insight is quite funny. And also, like, you know, there were a couple of people at that lunch with him who, one sadly dead now, but the other you may remember as a government minister, Mark Malik Brown.
Yep.
Now Lord Malik Brown. And they told me really funny things, like, you know, at the time, you know, if you think how close the various, well, St. James's Palace, Clarence House and Buckingham Palace are to Soho, Charles had never been to Soho at that point, he told them. You know, there are just all these things that royals don't do. And I dubbed the culture Planet Windsor when I got to know it better, because I realised they operate to completely different rules to the rest of humanity. And they breathe a different air.
Which is why I call my blog Planet Marbella, because I'm based in Marbella. And once again, the rules of normal Earth don't apply to Marbella either. But what we're looking at here is divine rule is about the role of queens and women in the royal family. I think the title's brilliant, because you come in, as you said, because you mentioned that you are a feminist. And we have as the public, as the loyal public, a very strange relationship with the women in royal circles. They are either, you know, sainted figures beyond repair and reproach, or they are these evil, they are just a few notches above Jezebel and various ladies of Babylon in our who are trying to wreck the monarchy. And this is not a new phenomenon, is it, Catherine?
No, I mean, I start with Anne Boleyn to prove exactly that point. And by the way, I would say they often end up three notches below Jezebel. And the other thing here is, the same royal woman can describe an arc from saint to sinner very, very fast. Or, as Camilla shows, you can go the opposite direction. You know, so that there you have someone who's gone from public enemy number one to sort of stalwart of the monarchy. But Anne Boleyn, the reason I start the book with her, first of all, she had to contend with mass media. You know, the rise of printing meant this explosion in sort of the dissemination of information, but also already misinformation. She's the first queen to be the subject of dueling biographies, you know, within minutes of her death, more or less. But even during her lifetime, the contemporaneous reports about her are really distorted by the sympathies of the people who are giving those reports. So she's caught up in the biggest culture war of all time, really, the Reformation.
Yeah.
And so her Catholic detractors paint her as a witch, whereas her Protestant supporters, of course, see her as a martyr. And that's where you get a lot of the wrong ideas about her, which were even easier to seed because, of course, Henry VIII wanted to expunge all trace of her. So he basically destroyed as many records of her as he could get hold of.
Not only that, but, you know, I did warn you previous to this interview, I am that worst sort of creature, armchair historian. I mean, I have a particular beef against the Tudors. Not as big a beef as I have against the Victorians, but that's another story because they write most of the history that people look at. However, Henry is a psychopath. Henry should be in a cell next to Hannibal Lecter if you're going to do great psychopaths of our time. You know, he basically tries. Not only does he wipe all trace of Anne Boleyn off the map as well, but also, you know, he's desperately after that heir. He needs to have a male progeny, and also the way that he treats, you know, his child by Anne Boleyn, of course, which is horrendous. And, you know, they are very lucky to survive as well. So an absolutely appalling human being. And you can see why Elizabeth I turns out to be such damaged goods as well afterwards.
Well, one of the things about Henry that I make in the book, which I think will shift some people's perception of the whole thing, is we're constantly being asked, even in the kind of critical appraisals of his reign, we're being asked to see him as a figure of power who exercised that power brutally. But actually, the more I looked at his reign, the more I understood that he acted out of weakness. And that also helps to explain his appalling treatment of the women in his life, you know, because England was, and you know, his land holdings were tiny compared to his biggest rivals in Europe at the time. And he was constantly sort of needing to raise money in order to raise armies, needing to form alliances because he wasn't strong enough on his own. And the women were supposed to not only provide heirs, which of course they kept not doing, or in the case of Jane Seymour doing and then dying.
Yeah.
But they also were supposed to bring alliances, and instead, you know, one of Anne Boleyn's misfortunes is to be their only, you know, a commoner who has links to the French court at a point where the Habsburgs are in the ascendant.
Yeah, and that's because England at the time, despite again what you might have read, you know, read about, you know, good, you know, good King Henry and all that, and but England is not the centre of power. You know, England is off, it hasn't even got a navy to talk of, and then, you know, that's gone with the Mary Rose. It's constantly in debt. The Habsburgs on the rise. Meanwhile, the Renaissance is going on in Italy and Florence and whatever. So, you know, England is this cold, wet rock over on the, you know, on the West Hand side. So it's not the centre of all human life, and that is why he is sort of thrashing around quite madly.
Exactly. But as I say, if you think about his sort of his portrayal in popular culture, we usually see him as, you know, this person striding around.
It's the codpiece, isn't it? Let's face it. It's the Holbein painting in the codpiece, Catherine.
And that Holbein painting. So a friend of mine was at Cambridge College I can't remember whether I mean Cambridge or Oxford. I think I mean Cambridge. And that Holbein painting was hanging over the dining room because the thing that she asked me two separate questions. One is, you know, at a time where we're reappraising historical figures because of their links to sort of terrible misdeeds, why was he still given pride of place like that? And the other was that this is a college that actually is supposed to have been founded by his last wife, Catherine Parr. So why is it not her portrait there? So his kind of like looming presence, I think, can be mistaken. But also the thing about his wives is we're not really supposed to like all of them, which is a point that popular musical Six tries to make, you know, that they're always pitted against each other. And so the other reason I start with Anne Boleyn is because royal women are, unlike most women to whom very little recorded history is devoted, royal women are the only women that we reliably get the stories of, but we don't get reliable stories of them because, and the distortions matter even more because they are among the few women who we always see who are very prominent.
I mean, just quickly, because I want to talk a few about the more modern women, if you like. But yeah. if we look at Henry and you look at Elizabeth I, but, you know, Mary, completely airbrushed, wrong, you know, Catholic, you know, known as Bloody Mary. She wasn't that bad. Married to Philip II of Spain. That's an alliance and a half if you want one. You know, and tragically misunderstood. And when she, you know, when she dies, Elizabeth comes in. And once again, we get that whole good queen, you know, good queen and the virgin queen and all that. And yet her, because of what she's witnessed, she doesn't have an heir. You know, England gets plunged into all sorts of, you know, people are not, you know, trying to throw princes out of the whole situation. And we end up with sort of James the Sixth of Scotland and James the First of England. So, you know, thanks for that, kids.
Yeah, well, one of the points I make in the book is precisely that. And also, you know, this notion of Mary is bloody is not untrue, but Elizabeth was bloodier.
Yeah.
So, you know, to the victor, the spoils, not in terms of like them actually being locked in a battle that way, but because of Protestantism becoming the state religion here. The Protestant narrative holds here, but if you look at how Elizabeth I is regarded in Ireland, for example, not popular at all. And, you know, a lot of countries quite rightly remember her role in the nascent slave trade as well. So another thing about these royal women is that they can mean whatever people want them to mean, depending where they are coming from and what they are trying to say about themselves, but also about women. And that's why they're all important figures. But it's important that we try and understand why we think what we think about them.
And let's just leap forward 400 years, shall we, to Queen Victoria. Again, an embodiment. You say that they can mean what they can be a cipher for how you want to represent either yourself or your views of the whole thing. Could we argue that Victoria then, I mean, we all think of Victoria as this sort of this grandmother type stern figure. You know, we don't really think of Victoria as a younger queen, and she comes to embody the empire and all those virtues, and that she's maybe helped by having her husband die early, and then she becomes this sort of saintly. She's a human being. We tend to forget that, but she's a human being, but she's seen as, you know, like the Virgin Queen, quote unquote, Elizabeth I. She is seen as being mother to the empire, etc.
Yeah, well, she, wildly misunderstood and misrepresented in so many different ways, in terms of popular images of her. I mean, for one thing, she loved sex. So the fact that, you know, and she kept diaries, so we know she loved sex. She, like, her description of her wedding has more capital letters in it than you can possibly imagine. And she did not, you know, she comes to stand for this notion before the death of Albert as there was a notion of the angel in the house, you know, this domestic, she kind of embodied this perfect domesticity from a distance. In reality, she really disliked having she didn't really like some of her children, but she particularly didn't like babies. And, you know, she talks about their peculiar frog-like movements. And Albert, her relationship with Albert is much more complicated than this sort of supposed perfect love affair. He, under modern definitions of coercive control, meets some of those descriptions, you know. And then her widowhood, I think the ways, first of all, she became deeply unpopular in her own reign for retreating into widowhood the way that she did. So this notion of her as the sort of wildly popular queen is overdone. Second of all, I suspect that in some of her avidity to prove her grief will have been a mixture of real grief and also sort of the guilt of that difficult relationship that they had. And then, of course, she has close relationships with men further on into her reign. John Brown, her gilly, Abdul Karim, who becomes her munshi. And her whole relationship with empire is also very curious because, you know, she imports all these people from India which she loves at a distance but never ever gets to visit, never sees it.
Yeah.
So she imports these men over to her court, then sort of makes them dress up in sort of her version of Indian costume and, you know, does all this crazy Orientalism and yet takes the trouble to learn Urdu and, you know, engages much more passionately than most people of her era do. Learns more, you know.
And rather than just sort of imposing and doing sort of Marie Antoinette in the village situation, she's actually engaging. I've only got 7 minutes left, so I want to kind of fast forward if I may. I'm just really interested and fascinated because you talk about the arc of Camilla from that woman through to embodying the, you know, look, seem like an anchor during some turbulent times. And then you look at Diana, you know, Prince, the blessed Diana, you know, I mean, and in some quarters, she's almost sainted. And, you know, for those of us who were working in media in the 90s, you know, we all remember the shock of that morning. But on the run-up to that, there was this whole situation of, well, what if she marries Dodi and Fayed? And what if she has a child with him? And the collywobbles that went through the establishment of that. So we're being very proactive in that whole Princess of Hearts thing and the unbelievable outpourings of grief that we saw on, you know, out in London. We all remember it very, very well. But it's really interesting in the way that, you know, they set up one as saint and one as sinner. And then you fast forward 30 years now, and then you see the same kind of way that that is happening in a certain section of the media with the Princess of Wales and, you know, she whose name cannot be mentioned, Markle, in certain sections of the press, which, you know, on my thing, I just go, you know, sweet Jesus and all the little angels, what is going on here?
Well, one of the things, if you look at the press that Diana got literally on the day she died, it is so vicious. I think we forget how much the press chops and changes its narrative. And I recognise we are both members of the media ourselves, and we understand that there is a need to change the record sometimes to find a new narrative. But it was so with Diana, it was absolutely vile, the stuff that was being written, not just the racism towards Stoney, but just about her. She was subject to, you know, if it's a shame Gucci doesn't make designer face zips, because then we could zip her mouth whenever she was about to say something. All of this stuff that was directed against her, her mothering criticised, everything else. What was written about Camilla was absolutely unforgivable as well. But as soon as Diana died, she was sanctified. You have seen with Kate, before Meghan came on the scene, there was actually increasingly critical reporting of Kate. She was referred to as the Duchess of Drab. She was criticised for being work shy, all of this stuff.
Yeah.
When Meghan first arrives, she's actually compared, Kate is compared negatively to her, less glamorous, all of this. But then it curdles and turns. And, you know, for all sorts of fairly obvious reasons, it's now gone so far the other way in some quarters. But what we have today that the others didn't contend with is the online armies. So whereas the reporting of Meghan is astonishingly negative, like, you can find all sorts of genuine reasons to criticize her or question her, but the levels of hatred, what on earth has this woman done that makes people actually loathe her? That is one of the mechanisms that I answer that question, but I kind of challenge people to ask about it, ask themselves about it. And with any of these women, we're so easily persuaded into pitting them against each other, hating on them. And I think that not only damages those women, and if you care about the monarchy, it damages the monarchy, which is supposed to unify, but it also damages the wider world,
yeah.
And not least in terms of views of women.
Well, exactly. This is the whole thing. If you pit women against women on that level, you know, on the esteemed level of monarchy, then you're going to be pitting all women against women, and that is unacceptable. And for those who applauded so heartily when Earl Spencer said he was going to bring up the boys as, you know, as Diane would have wished, well, I'm sure that she would have wished that, you know, that Harry didn't go through the drab existence and goes and lives his own life as his own person, you know, and therefore Meghan should be thanked for actually opening his eyes to that and a wider world. But nay, you know, how dare she take him from us, etc.
Yes, well, I mean, it's so, again, if you look at the mechanisms, there's now new stuff that they have to contend with as well. You spend 5 minutes on TikTok, you find extraordinary deep fakes where they're reviving the dead. So they pit, you know, you actually have Camilla and Diana fighting, for example. But it's quite funny if you don't kind of understand, if you don't think about the world that doesn't know that these things didn't happen, that these aren't real clips. And, you know, we are living in a world where there is absolutely credible information to link some of the online battle between Kate and Meghan and with other royal women to state actors like China and Russia and Iran and, you know, online troll farms and the far right and whatever. So, yes, we should worry about this, but mostly we should question why we let ourselves be pulled into these things. And I think the stories of the real women are so much more interesting.
I could talk to you a bit of this, but unfortunately, I'm about to do the cardinal sin of media and crash the international news. The book is called Divide and Rule, Raw Women and Their Battles. It's by the brilliant Catherine Mayer. Catherine, if people want to find you online, where's the best place to find you and say nice things to you?
On social media, I call myself Mayer, M-A-Y-E-R, of London. It does mean that I get quite a lot of complaints for Sadiq Khan, but no, I'm Mayer, not Mayor of London.
Wonderful. Listeners, you can go onto our virtual bookstore and buy it by clicking on the front cover as well. The book is called Divide and Rule. It's by Catherine Mayer, as in Mayor of London. Catherine, it's been absolutely wonderful to speak to you this morning.
Thank you. Thank you very much.